So I'd like to talk about this topic that Ellen just described, what I call a fresh look at beginner's mind, mainly because this is one of the most important aspects of the Buddhist teachings in my own experience. It's a topic that I return to repeatedly and find new learning and new insight in when I return to it. Some of you are probably aware of the fact that it's associated with Zen teacher Suzuki Roshi, who started the San Francisco Zen Center in the 1960s. And it's also associated with a somewhat classic book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is a book of his Dharma talks from those days. I think what's important to me about it is really the fact that there's a way in which it reminds us that the possibility of a fresh start is always available to us. And while I think many of us understand this intellectually, there's a way in which we so often get kind of caught or locked into certain habitual patterns of thinking, speaking, and behaving. I guess the other aspect of it that I think is worth mentioning is that you can understand this idea of beginner's mind as representing the way in which Buddhist teachings teach us a different way of knowing ourselves and the world. I came across a story when I was putting this talk together in which a reporter approached Mother Teresa and said to her, when you pray to God, what do you say? Only an American reporter would ask that question. Right? And she said, I don't say anything. I just listen. To which the reporter said, what does God say to you? And Mother Teresa responded, he doesn't say anything. He just listens. And then she went on to say to this reporter, and if you don't understand that, I really can't help you. But what she was pointing out that I think a lot of us have experienced in our own lives and spiritual practice is that the teachings are teaching us a different way of accessing our world. And that different way is fundamentally non-conceptual. It has a quality of directness, of openness, and of immediacy. In fact, a certain kind of intimacy, if you will. Right? It also represents the fact that the teachings are saying we need to learn how to make the present moment our reference point for reality. And again, phrases like living in the now or being here now or the power of now are pretty cliched at this point in some spiritual circles. And at the same time, if we take a fresh look at what those phrases are pointing out and the direction that they're encouraging us to move with our lives, they're quite profound, actually. I remember when The Power of Now came out, for example, when Eckhart Tolle wrote that book, and it was more or less flying off the shelves as a spiritual bestseller. I thought I knew what it was about after having read it. And then a client that I was working with came into my office and gave me a sort of a miniature version of it, like a gift copy. And I thought I knew what it was all about. And then I looked more closely at what he had given me because it was the same exact color and cover. But when I looked closely, it said, the power of then. Right? And it was a spoof on Tolle's book. The author's name was Swami Wuddha Kuddha Shuddha. And it had an endorsement on the back by His Holiness the Dalai Lama that said, huh? So there was this quality of not getting what I expected, right? And what beginner's mind is about is just that. It's about showing up so fully and completely in the moments of our lives and inhabiting them so completely that we disengage our identification with our preconceptions about what ought to happen. And when we do that, there's a whole new world that begins to unfold in our actual experience. Let me give you another example. This one's a story that someone shared with me. There was a powerful emperor who needed a new head samurai. So he sent out a declaration throughout the country that he was searching for one. A year passed, and only three people showed up: a Japanese samurai, a Chinese samurai, and a Jewish samurai. The emperor asked the Japanese samurai to come in and demonstrate why he should be head samurai. The Japanese samurai opened a matchbox, and out popped a bumblebee. Whoosh went his sword, and the bumblebee dropped dead on the ground in two places. The emperor exclaimed, "That is impressive." The emperor then asked the Chinese samurai to come in and demonstrate his skills. The Chinese samurai also opened a matchbox, and out buzzed a fly. Whoosh, whoosh went his sword, and the fly dropped dead on the ground in four small pieces. The emperor exclaimed, "Now that is really very impressive." The emperor then had the Jewish samurai demonstrate why he should be head samurai. The Jewish samurai opened a matchbox, and out flew a gnat. His flashing sword went whoosh, 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 whoosh. And the gnat was still alive and flying around. The emperor, who was obviously disappointed, asked, "After all of that, why is the gnat not dead?" The Jewish samurai smiled. "Well," he replied, "circumcision is not meant to kill." The emperor thought he knew what was happening, right? But he got a fresh look. He got surprised in the moment. So what do we mean by fresh start, right? Because when we have a beginner's mind, we recognize that every moment is unpredictable fundamentally, and that a fresh start is always possible. Well, I would suggest to you that this applies on many, many levels of our lives. Let's take sitting meditation, for example. Right? I can sit down, say I'm working with Anapanasati practice, paying attention to the breath. Every time the mind wanders from the breath and the attention goes elsewhere, I notice it, I come back, and I start fresh. I can go away for 5 minutes or 15 minutes or half an hour. But the moment I come back, I'm in awareness and there's a felt experience of living in a body and being awake and aware. I can be someone who's had a 25-year meditation practice and go on 3 business trips in a row and watch that practice dissolve and stop meditating. Maybe for 6 days or 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years. But at one point, I can get up the next morning, I can sit down on that cushion or chair, and I can start again with the practice. So the principle here, in my mind, is somewhat like the Buddhist version of the good news. Right? It is possible to start fresh on so many different levels, and these are just some practice-related examples. How about if we go through a difficult depression? I used to do a lot of clinical psychotherapy with people, and I would see people go through some very deep, dark, and painful places. And sometimes, with a combination of different kinds of help and sometimes complementary medical support, I would see people emerge from those depressions and, in a sense, start fresh, begin their life again. The novelist Barbara Kingsolver describes what I'm talking about here in this way. And I have to imagine some of us can relate to what she's saying. Every one of us is called upon, probably many times, to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, a loss of a job or a limb, or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. It's impossible to think at first how this will all work. Eventually, what moves us forward is the subterranean ebb and flow of being alive among the living. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window. And then another, my daughter in a yellow dress. And another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon. Until I learned to be in love with my life again. Like a stroke victim, retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again. And beginner's mind, the way that I'm talking about it and understanding it at this point in my own life and practice, is what enables that to be possible. It's showing up in the present moment in an embodied way and opening to whatever that present moment is with a non-judging perspective, a quiet mind, and an open heart, if you will. Another aspect of this that comes into play is the discovery we make when we explore beginner's mind of the central role that intentionality plays in a conscious life. I think it's not an accident that when the Buddha taught about the law of karma, what he emphasized was intentionality. And essentially what he said was that it's the intention behind an action that is its primary determinant of the fruit. Why? Because we have a very limited amount of control over the outcomes of our actions. Even when they're skillful, sometimes we're surprised at the outcomes. However, we have a lot to say about the intention that gives rise to an action. And if we practice mindfulness and we practice exploring beginner's mind, we'll also notice that an intention precedes any voluntary thought, word, or action. If I can become aware of the intention that precedes a thought, word, or action, I can then make a choice, an evaluation, if you will, using discriminating wisdom as to whether or not it's skillful and something that should be expressed. Yeah? So intentionality comes into play here in a really significant way. It actually ends up shaping the way our character unfolds and evolves over time. And it's one of the determinants of whether or not what we develop as we move forward through our lives involves what I would call wholesome emotions and wholesome ways of being, or unwholesome or unskillful ways of being. It's also something that can never be taken away from us. I remember reading Viktor Frankl's book at one point, Man's Search for Meaning. And one of the most poignant things he said in that book, when he was describing his experience of being in the death camps, was that they could take everything away from us, absolutely everything, except the choice of what attitude we would choose toward what we were experiencing. No one could take that away. Jack Kornfield put it this way. He said, whatever your difficulties, a devastated heart, financial loss, feeling assaulted by the conflicts around you, or a seemingly hopeless illness, you can always remember that you are free in every moment to set the compass of your heart to your highest intentions. In fact, the two things that you are always free to do, despite your circumstances, are to be present and to be willing to love. There's a writer some of you might have come across who also is a surgeon. I don't know if he's still doing medical work. His name's Richard Selzer. And he's written a few different books about his work as a medical doctor at performing surgery. In one of them, he did a beautiful job of capturing this quality of choosing how we want to relate to a given situation. This is how he describes it. I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face post-operative, her mouth twisted in palsy, clownish. A tiny twig of the facial nerve, the one to the muscles of her mouth, has been severed. She will be thus from now on. As surgeon, I had followed with religious fervor the curve of her flesh. I promise you that. Nevertheless, to remove the tumor in her cheek, I had to cut the little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me, private. Who are they? I ask myself. He and this wry mouth, who gaze and touch each other so generously. The woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this? She asks. Yes, I say. It is because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent. But the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. All at once, I know who he is. I understand and I lower my gaze. One is not bold in an encounter with a god. Unmindful of my presence, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth. And I'm so close, I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate hers, to show her that their kiss still works. I remember that the gods appeared in ancient Greece as mortals, and I hold my breath, and I let the wonder in. That young man had a choice and saw what the circumstance involved and opened his heart to the new reality and related to his wife with a beginner's mind. She related to herself in a similar manner. Their lives will be different going forward. A third aspect of this that I want to talk about has to do with the relationship between the experience of openness that I associate with beginner's mind and forgiveness. Because in order to forgive, we have to draw upon some of the central insights in Buddhist practice. That is to say, the insight into anicca, or impermanence, the fact that life itself and we ourselves are on the most profound level a process, constantly in flux and forever changing. And also the teaching on anatta or anatta, depending on who you listen to. The emptiness of self. part of not being able to forgive when we're unable to do that involves solidifying someone who has harmed us, be that physically, emotionally, spiritually, or perhaps all of those. It's as if we lock into a view of who that person was and is, and we're unwilling to release that perspective. Given the way trauma works, we also tend in situations like that to lock into a view of ourselves and a certain set of beliefs about what we should or shouldn't have done or what we should have done differently in a given situation. And we solidify that as well. Now, certainly, traumatic experience is extremely complex, psychologically, physically, and otherwise. So I don't want to oversimplify it by any means. However, most of us, I think, have come to see in our own lives that if what we want to do is awaken spiritually, learning to be forgiving, both of ourselves and of other people, seems to play a very important role. In a sense, it represents a kind of letting go, often preceded by a letting be, simply because we can't change the past. Right? If someone has injured me or I've injured someone, there's never going to be a chance to undo that. However, we can change our way of relating to what's occurred in the past. We can soften up the tendency that a lot of us have to be perfectionistic and to live with a highly critical superego that in one form or another frequently gives us the message that we're still not good enough. We're not getting it right yet. We're not worthy of love yet. And somehow we need to try harder, if you will. When we do that kind of inner work, particularly when we learn to be forgiving toward ourselves, there's a way in which we cultivate a kind of self-compassion and kindness. Some of you are probably aware of how popular self-compassion is becoming in Buddhist and other spiritual circles. Right? For many years, we had mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was a great help to many, many people. Now we have the work of Chris Germer and Kristen Neff, two psychologists and meditation teachers who are teaching people how to be kinder to themselves. Because if we can't forgive ourselves, it's extremely difficult to forgive another. When we learn to forgive ourselves and open our hearts to ourselves and step back away from that habitual perfectionism, there's a kind of loving kindness that begins to infuse our lives and allows us to soften our hearts in relation to ourselves. The writer Annie Lamott, perhaps familiar to some of you, learned how to do that over a long number of years. And she describes it in this little excerpt. Sometimes faith looks like myopia. I don't see everyone's faults so clearly as I used to, let alone my own. The God of my later years is not interested in my pores or cellulite and hopes that I will stop noticing yours. My vision has blessedly blurred. This is a great advantage when you're trying to live more spiritually, more expansively. More like Zorba the Greek and less like the church lady. For instance, when I sit on my bed now writing on my iPad, the top roll of my tummy sometimes creeps over onto the screen and starts typing away. In the old days, upon noticing this unsought collaboration, I would have decided to start a new diet or possibly to end it all. Now I think to myself, who knows? Maybe it's got something interesting to add. K. Can you feel the kindness? Right? That took her many years. I mean, she was struggled with alcohol addiction for many years. She was hypercritical of her own writing, even though she had tremendous success as a writer. And as she's gotten into her later years, she describes the way in which she's finally learning how to appreciate the person that she is and let go of the person that she ought to be or wishes she could be. More, she's learning to settle back into the moment with a beginner's mind, with a sense of presence, and seeing clearly who and how she actually is, rather than pushing for something else. There's a particular version of forgiveness meditation that I've worked on and off with for many years, taught by a monastic named Ajahn Pasano, who's the abbot of a monastery in Northern California called Abhayagiri Monastery. And as some of you know, there's many different kinds of forgiveness practices and prayers that we can do, oftentimes as a preliminary to other practices, like Vipassana or loving kindness practice, sometimes as an end in itself. Ajahn Pasano's version, I'm going to share with you, just so that you can get a sense of how it invites us to learn to be with what is, including the mistakes we make and the unskillful actions that we commit, and to recognize that life itself, or what we call the spiritual journey, the spiritual path, is fundamentally a process of learning. And that learning often involves making mistakes. One of my favorite sayings in the Zen tradition is a saying that says, the entire spiritual path is one continuous mistake. Because that's really where the learning often occurs. Right? And Pasano makes the point, I think quite appropriately, that forgiveness can never be forced. It's not something that we do as an act of will. So if you haven't worked with forgiveness practices before and they're of interest to you, I would recommend that you start with easy situations, not that really difficult person or situation that has been unresolved for many, many years, for example. Right? So think of it as being similar to starting weightlifting. You start with the light weights, and then you move into something complex, like our politicians, for example. Right? Things of that sort. And this is how he describes this. Right? Think of ways in which you've harmed yourself and harmed others. Better to begin with minor things, as I just mentioned. And as far as you're able to do so, that's a phrase he uses a lot, extend forgiveness to yourself for this harming by saying these phrases to yourself. I allow myself to be imperfect. I allow myself to make mistakes. I allow myself to be a learner, still learning life's lessons. There's the beginner's mind again, right? I forgive myself. And then his last line is very important. If I'm unable to forgive myself now, may I forgive myself at some point in the future. And there's that seed of intention that we talked about a little earlier. I plant the seed of intention to eventually forgive myself. I work with that. As I learn to do that, I then begin to extend it to others. I bring someone to mind who has done injury to me. And in the same way, just as I allow myself to be imperfect, I sense or feel or visualize that person, I allow you to be imperfect. Just as I allow myself to make mistakes, I allow you to make mistakes. As I allow myself to be a learner, still learning life's lessons, I allow you to be a learner, still learning life's lessons. I forgive you. If I cannot forgive you now, may I forgive you at some time in the future? And then the last part has to do with recognizing that we have also done harm to others at times. And we bring the person to mind that we may have harmed in one way or another. And in our mind's eye, we ask that person for forgiveness. Please allow me to make mistakes. Please allow me to be imperfect. Please allow me to be a learner, still learning life's lessons. Please forgive me. If you cannot forgive me now, may you forgive me at some time in the future. So what we're doing is we're orienting toward the reality of the present. We're acknowledging the feelings. To the extent that we're able and ready, we're releasing the judgment or the anger or the resentment or whatever it might be. And we're recognizing that we might have to do this many times in some situations where there's been deep pain and great injury. This may have to be something that's done on a regular basis, for example. So the aspects of beginner's mind that I want to be unpacking here, this idea of fresh start, the significance of intentionality in the process, and the recognition that it plays a key role in the unfolding of karma in our lives, the importance of forgiveness. And the last part has to do with really our vision of awakening itself. At some point after a certain number of years of practice, I had a realization that in my experience, one way that I could understand what we call spiritual awakening, the process itself, was a continuously evolving understanding of what enlightenment or awakening is. That has changed so much since I first got involved with meditation as an undergraduate student of 21. When I first got involved with the process, I was an undergraduate psychology student at Tulane University in New Orleans, which was really a fine, fine training ground for the path of hedonism, essentially. And after a couple of years of playing that out with great gusto and wholeheartedness, I got really depressed and anxious and realized that I had played out a lot of what the culture had taught me was going to bring happiness, and it was a bust. And so I got into meditation, and I was, you know, with the zealousness that any new convert experiences something new. I started to do a lot of hatha yoga practices. I stopped smoking drugs. I stopped smoking cigarettes. I stopped hanging out in the French Quarter until 3-4 in the morning on a regular basis. And I began to eat well and do these postures and sit at that point in mantra meditation. Gave up a number of my friends because the relationships were actually quite superficial, I realized, and most of what we did together was get high, essentially. And I started to feel incredibly good. Somewhat stunned that one could feel that good legally, actually. it was rather amazing. But my view of the path was essentially a straight line in this direction. That all I had to do, the more I practiced, the better. And I would go from being this unhappy, anxious, depressed kid to this really happy guy without any bumps along the way. And it was not too long into that process that I started to realize that it just wasn't that simple. Right? It was more like a spiral of some sort. And sometimes I still got depressed, and I still felt lonely, and I still felt needy in a way that was humiliating and embarrassing, that I felt shame about. Right? And that's when I got into Gestalt therapy as a client, started to blend in some Western psychological work with the meditation and the yoga. And still, I saw that there were dark times and there were light times, if you will. When I look at how my vision of awakening has unfolded since, it's been through a lot of variations, frankly. I remember Mother Teresa, for example, at one point describing her relationship with the divine by saying, "I'm a pencil in the hand of God." The poet Rumi described awakening in this way. He said, "This is how a human being can change. There's a worm addicted to eating grape leaves. Suddenly, he wakes up. Call it grace, whatever. Something wakes him, and he's no longer a worm. He's the entire vineyard, and the orchard, too. The fruit, the trunks, a growing wisdom and joy that doesn't need to devour." So that was a different way to understand it. It seemed to be pointing to the fact that if we want to live an awakened life, we have to be willing to open our embrace to what the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Because when the heart is wide open, we're going to feel it all. That's just true. Then I came across yet another perspective on awakening. This one kind of challenging because it plugged into my perfectionism and superego a bit. If you can start the day without caffeine or pep pills, if you can be cheerful, ignoring aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, if you can eat the same food every day and be grateful for it, if you can understand when loved ones are too busy to give you time, if you can overlook when people take things out on you, when through no fault of yours something goes wrong, if you can take criticism and blame without resentment, if you can face the world without lies and deceit, if you can conquer tension without medical help, if you can relax without liquor, if you can sleep without the aid of drugs, then you are probably a cat or a dog. Right. So what am I saying here? All right, let me see if I can sum this up because I want to allow some time for discussion. Yeah. I would suggest to you that this notion of beginner's mind, for those of you who are drawn to it, is a potentially very fruitful inquiry in Buddhist practice. And I think that there's a lot of different layers and levels to what it means, which I hopefully was able to unpack a little bit. Right? One of them I suggested is this idea of fresh start. Right? That we can always start fresh when we come into the moment fully and completely. Whether that's coming back to the breath, coming back to the cushion after a long absence, coming back to life after a medical disaster or problem, whether that's coming to a new job after losing one, or finding a new partner after a divorce. There's always this possibility of a new beginning. And that's very good news from my perspective. It takes a lot of courage to start over again, oftentimes. But it works for people who choose to do it. One more story about Fresh Start, actually, that comes to mind. I had a friend last year who was a retired psychologist, and at a time in his life where he was going to begin to travel and enjoy his life, he'd closed his practice to move from New Mexico to Boulder, and was really ready to celebrate in a certain way. He was in his early 70s. His name was Lou. Right? And Lou had a couple of sons, one in Boulder and one who was teaching at a university in Melbourne, Australia. So he decided he wanted to go see his son, Adam, and visit with him and travel in New Zealand and Australia, which he did. And when he got there, sadly, he started to feel quite ill. And one thing led to the next. They went to get some medical help. Lou was diagnosed with fourth stage metastatic lung cancer. Out of the middle of nowhere. This is somebody who worked out on a regular basis, did the right things, and so forth. And he knew that I used to direct hospice programs, among other things, and that I spent a lot of time working with Ram Dass and Stephen Levine's Dying Project back in the 80s. So we talked quite a bit about his situation, and he decided to try a relatively new drug that targeted that particular type of cancer that he had. But for the most part, he was beginning to say his goodbyes to people. And I was heartbroken. This is a really, really beautiful man. I go to my email one day, and there's an email from Lou. He gave me permission to share this. To my dear friends and family members far and wide, as you all know, I've been on death's, if not door, then at least in the driveway. Just 3 months ago, with lung cancer, it spread widely in my body, according to the PET CT scan at the time. Well, today I got the results of another PET scan taken this week, and I am cancer-free. Nothing, nada, not a speck anywhere. Now, PET and CT scans don't measure cancer at the molecular level where it can reside and reassert at a later time. But the targeted drug therapy that I've been on for less than 3 months, a drug called Tarceva, has miraculously killed off all the active growing cancer cells. And when my body begins to resist this drug somewhere down the road, I have at least two more lines of defense against this disease. And who knows what else is in the pipeline after that. So to all of you who worried and were shocked and aggrieved at what had befallen me, and who also prayed, sent good wishes, visited, helped me stand physically and walk, and were there with me in spirit, I thank you for all of that and more, because somewhere during these months my spirit revived and my body accepted the gift of healing that was evoked not only by the medicine and wonderful care I received during the darkest days, but also by your love and caring. I also came to a place of gratitude for my life and for the beauty of all that I feel connected to in the best and the worst of times. All of that and more led me today to not be truly surprised by this wonderful news. Inside, I knew it already. In love and gratitude, Lou. Talk about a beginner's mind. His description of what life feels like now is wide open. He was ready to sign off. Absolutely. Wanted to spend a lot of time with his grandkids, with his son in Boulder, trying to decide when his son would come into Boulder from Australia. And the whole thing turned around. That's a fresh start. Absolutely. And the other aspects that I included in the unpacking process of how I understand beginner's mind, when I take a fresh look at it, included intentionality, and the importance of that, included connecting it to forgiveness and the way we can learn to be with the truth of what has happened and at the same time recognize the changing nature of people and situations, including ourselves. And then this idea of taking a fresh look at the vision we're holding for why we practice at all. Why do we meditate? Why do we study the teachings? Why do we do service work? What's the vision that we're holding that motivates us to work with the practices? Rather than suggesting that there's any right way that we should envision that process, what I'm suggesting is that we should be in an ongoing relationship with that process as our understanding of it evolves. So I want to close with one more vision of that awakening process, this one going all the way back to Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now, that came out in 1970. This is a quote that I've returned to countless times, especially when I'm going through difficulties. This is how Ram Dass understood the awakening process at that point in time. What is happening to you is nothing less than death and rebirth. What is dying is the entire way in which you understood who you are and how it all is. What is being reborn is the child of the spirit for whom all things are new. This process of attending an ego that is dying at the same time that you are going through a birth process is awesome. Be gentle and honor that, the small self, which is dying, and that, the true self, which is being born.